817 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to direct the issuance of $10 million in general obligation bonds for pollution control. It specifies that the proceeds are to be used for the identification, categorization, and removal or remediation of mercury leachate from abandoned gold and mercury mines. It directs the Department of Environmental Quality to report no later than January 1, 2005 to the Legislative Assembly on the scope of the problem, identification of mines, and plan for removal or remedial action. Mr. Chair, we have received a potential revenue impact statement on the measure, as well as a notice of potential fiscal impact. Because it is a bonding measure, we will need to send it to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'm going to ask Bob Danko and Keith Johnson to come up. As they're coming up, however, the fact sheet that got my attention from DEQ is in your packet, I'm assuming. Oregon's hard rock mine cleanup problem. Some interesting. Well, I don't know if it is or not. Did this not get copied for everybody else?
Mr. Chair, we have that.
Oh, you have it.
Given the entire committee.
Okay, so the committee will get it in a few minutes. I only wish that the picture was in color that's on there, because the stuff coming out of the mine is essentially orange. The stream. Anyway. Bob, are you the one that wants to to begin this morning? That's okay, no problem.
Good. These for me.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. With me today is Keith Johnson. Keith is a manager at the department who coordinates what we call cross-program activities, issues and work that we do that split some of our divisional way we're organized. So Keith, one of the areas that Keith is oversees is abandoned mines and the cleanup of abandoned mines. And so he's come down today, and I think we have a pretty good presentation to give you today. Just before Keith does his background on abandoned mines, I just want to talk a little bit about set the stage for him. This bill isn't our bill. It's a bill that I believe was created by Oregon Environmental Council, and I think Matt Blevins is here today, and he can talk about the bill, the specifics of the bill. We have been doing some abandoned mine cleanup work under our state orphan site cleanup program. Orphan sites are high priority contaminated sites that don't really have a responsible party that has the ability or is available to clean up the sites, and they fall to the state for cleaning up. We have about 40 orphan sites around the state that we are presently working on. About five of those are abandoned mines. Obviously, we, as you'll see today, we feel we need to do much more on abandoned mines, and it becomes obviously a resource question. In planning for this session, we worked with our field staff and with others, and we had shaped a proposed orphan site bond sale to be proposed to this legislature of $6.6 million and laid out exactly how we would have spent that money on abandoned mines. Of course, that never made it through the budgeting process, because there's no way to pay. There was no way or easy way for us to determine how to pay back those bonds. General funds wasn't an option for us as we put our budget together. So that proposal isn't before the legislature, though we spent some time during the interim in shaping it. You notice, Mr. Chair, committee members, we're neutral on the bill. We're basically, required to be neutral on the bill if the bill has a fiscal impact outside of the governor's budget, proposed budget. Obviously, we think abandoned mine work is a high priority for us. And finally, if the committee is would like to move this bill, we would like to work with the chair and the committee and staff and OEC and others. There's a few changes we would make to the bill, maybe to allow us to implement it better and also to maybe lower the fiscal impact on the reporting part of the bill. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Keith, and we'll talk about abandoned mine cleanup.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before we move on, Bob, one question I would have is the discussion in the building the last couple of days has been around the downgrading of our bonding capacity with Moody's and Fitch's. Have you done any analysis of what the issuance of these bonds, how they would be impacted by those changes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, no. That is something that's way beyond me, and I'm sure I can go back and deal with the executive branch in some way to talk about that, but not me.
Well, I presume that would be a Ways and Means discussion anyway. Okay, thanks.
I'm very interested in the background and the problem itself. I'm assuming you're going to show us some slides. They'll have a little better definition than the black and white copies we have.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Just for the record, my name is Keith Johnson. A little bit of background on myself. I've been with the agency for about a year now, a little over a year. Previous to that, I worked in private industry as a manager of a hazardous waste and transportation disposal company for about 10 years. I have a background in chemistry, and I thank you for the opportunity to present this material to you. My intention here today is just to provide some background as far as what DEQ can tell you about the abandoned mine problem. My intention is to go through a little bit of historical information in terms of how these mines worked, why they're there, and what role they played for Oregon back when they were operating, and then follow that into some examples today of the legacy of some of those sites and tie those operations to the problems we see today. And followed up with a little bit of conversation of how we deal with these sites currently and how we fund them and what we think is important. So to do that, I've got a show here. But
do your show.
Okay. I'll just talk off of off the slides. And
this Black Butte mine, I can see from my house.
Is that right?
Black Butte is not the real, you know, Black Butte everybody thinks of. It is the, in the South Valley, it is the mountain that all the
I see something.
Planes use to do visual navigation into the valley. It's one of the things that's on their navigational charts. That's the only reason I knew about it.
Okay, I think we're ready to go here. The problems we're talking that I want to talk about here today were caused by practices and areas that happened a long time ago. These are legacy sites. Many of these sites were opened in the 1800s for the purposes of mining mercury, gold, copper, other precious metals. And what I want to do is in that context, these sites took place and operated with really no environmental regulation at all. In the presentation today, my goal is to show you how the results of these old practices have caused some of the problems we see today in some of these watersheds, and show you some example sites. By way of background also, is there are no commercial mining operations in Oregon right now. These are all legacy sites. We consider them inactive sites. There are, of course, some hobby miners and some other types of mines that are still out there, but And the other statement is that I'd like to make is these mine sites may constitute the biggest uncontrollable source or biggest controllable source of mercury that we know of that's being released into some of the waterways we have. Just a little topography here. The mining problem, the abandoned mine problem, is a statewide problem. Abandoned mine sites are located really throughout the entire state. In working with our interagency mining group, we've identified over 1,000 mine sites across the state that are abandoned. And these range really from anywhere from just dog holes in the ground to major mining, legacy mining operations. As you can see, the state is fairly rich in topography with mountainous regions all across it, and the geology of the state is such that there is significant concentrations of mercury that gets mined across the state, as well as some of these other precious metals. The way we do a lot of this mining work is through an interagency mining group that we participate in. And this interagency mining group consists of members of DEQ, DGAMI, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, EPA, Forest Service, BLM, and the Army Corps. And through those efforts to look at these many mine sites, we've basically narrowed down to 140 that we've actually done some site assessment and some more than cursory look at. So we have about 140 mine sites. Also, the type of mine sites I want to talk about today, there's two sites. There's hard rock type mines, and then there's what we call placer mines. The mines I'll talk about today and the mines we look at primarily are hard rock mines, which is the tunneling, the digging out from shafts. Placer mines are more of use water to do more of a rinsing process in a stream, and in that process it becomes very difficult to identify and clean up contamination, as it's mainly just washed away. Within the state, out in the eastern regions, there's historically been a lot of gold and copper and silver mining. As we get into the west side and in southern Oregon and Umpqua and Rogue, we get in also to that type of mining. And as you go north into the Cottage Grove area and up through Clackamas, you see a lot more of the mercury mining. But again, it is a statewide issue. A little bit of the history on mining and how it's been done. Mining was obviously just a matter of digging out in the tunnels. The ore was either blasted or dug out and moved out of the mines in crushed form manually. It was a very intense process. They used these shafts and these mechanical means to dig the mineral-rich ores and send them through shafts to the processing areas outside of the mine. And various means were used to do this. Another byproduct of the mining was basically just the waste rock that didn't have any value that also had to be removed. And this material was also pulled out of the mines and placed in heaps and tailing piles. Some of this material does contribute, we believe, to the contamination problems we see. And obviously there's a large volume of this kind of material out there. Once the material was outside of the mine, it was often piled up in heaps and for processing. What you see on the left side is basically the disposal of either waste rock or the spent tailing piles. On the right, what you'll see is this is a huge rock crusher, a processing mill. And the way this worked was the mineral-rich ore was dumped in the top of this thing, and the huge press at the bottom would crush and size the rock for processing to remove the the minerals that they were looking for. As you see on the left, however, you know, gravity was a law then, and it's a law now, and they use that quite a bit to dispose of and store up the tailing piles. And this is part of the problem we see, is that these tailing piles tend to be on slopes where gravity worked the best. And, of course, at the bottom of slopes, you often have the streams and the rivers that are now affected by this material. This is a slide that shows gold processing, another use of mercury. Outside of just mining for mercury's sake, was in the amalgamation process of gold. Mercury adheres to gold, and so if you wash the rock or the mining material with mercury as a product, it's very effective in pulling the gold out. And once the gold was pulled out, the mercury gold amalgam was then cooked or heated in these types of baths here, and the condensate was then collected in kind of a radiator fashion through condensation. So their intention, of course, is to recover the mercury they use. They can reuse it, but we believe a lot of the mercury escaped this process through evaporation, which mercury is wont to do. In fact, in looking through some of the journals, we found references to mercury basically hanging from the trees and dripping off the branches near some of these milling operations, just from how it was used. So that's a little bit of the overview of how mercury was mined and how it was used in other mining processes. What I'd like to do now is turn your attention to four specific sites around the state that DEQ has done some work on. These represent really our some of our highest priority sites taken from around the state. We have the Red Boy site in Grant County, close to Granite. We have the Black Butte mine right outside of Cottage Grove, the Bonanza mine, which is close to Sutherland, and then finally the Formosa Silver Butte complex, which is right outside of the town of Riddle. The first site is the Red Boy mine. The Red Boy mine was, as it shows here, was opened in 1886, primarily for gold, silver, and copper mining. It is part of a complex of mines in the area. We've looked at a couple others that we feel are priorities as well. However, Red Boy is really the highest priority site in that complex. It's a fairly extensive mine. It has many thousand feet of mine shafts and one on-site mill. And which is typical of abandoned mines and legacy mining. It was closed and sold at a sheriff sale in 1916.
What's the material coming out of the mine?
The material you see coming out is a phenomenon known as acid mine drainage. It's material, it's water that basically collects through filtration or precipitation in the mine shafts and periodically will be emitted or trickle out of the what we call the mine adit or the mine shaft. It typically carries concentrations of heavy metals and has a very low pH. This particular event here was kind of a one-time, what I would refer to as a burp of material. Red Boy collects water and periodically discharges it, but the one of the shafts, this is a couple years ago, collapsed and emitted quite a bit of material into the stream, which you'll also see in this next slide here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So do you actually do a chemical analysis of that then?
Yes, there has been some analysis of this material that shows these high concentrations.
And this is where it goes into another stream?
Yeah, this is the stream, Mr. Chair, that runs in front of the Red Boy mine. I'm It's part of Congo Gulch and Clear Creek. And there has been some somewhat informal tests on impacts that were done a couple years ago that showed an impact to the ability of fish. This is a habitat for a couple of salmonid species, I believe, that shows some impacts to their ability to live there.
Now we know where salmon gets its color.
The issues with this mine site are obviously the discharge of the acid mine drainage, and also there are significant large tailing piles right adjacent to the creek that we believe have elevated concentrations of arsenic and a couple other heavy metals that are at the risk of collapsing into the creek. So we'd certainly like to be able to do something about that site. The second site I'd like to present to you is Black Butte Mine. This mine is located in Lane County and operated up until about 1966. It was a mercury mine and one of the second most productive mercury mine in the state. We believe it to be a major contributor of mercury into its watershed. We've done some analysis of sediment and soil samples in the area, and we do see some elevated mercury concentrations. It also drains, the watershed drains into the Cottage Grove Reservoir, which also shows some elevated mercury concentrations. We believe this to be a major contributor to that mercury problem in the reservoir. Again, it was a very productive site for the production of mercury, and the main hazard, the main danger we believe is in these tailing piles that you see. The tailing piles are basically adjacent to Dennis Creek, as you can see by this picture. They again, they use gravity, so they just stacked it down the hill. Some of these tailing piles are actually in the creek, so we believe the leachate from the rainwater provides to the tailings piles is the source of that mercury into the stream. Since Black Butte is the first mercury mine that I've showed you, just a little background into how these mercury releases take place and the types of things we look at when we're trying to devise solutions to these. Black Butte Mine is in the Bohemia Mining District, which is a fairly active district in mercury mining. We believe there's a variety of potential sources of mercury within this district. Obviously, the soil and the natural geology of this area is mercury-rich, and there is some contribution of that background mercury that's going to be a factor in the levels of mercury we see in these streams. Exactly what that level is, I wouldn't want to speculate in front of the committee, but we believe it's there. However, these mine sites, we also believe, are significant contributors of mercury. Basically, what you do when you're mining is you're pulling these mineral-rich rocks and stacking them in a weatherable location. So there's atmospheric deposition as part of the crushing and the cooking process to pull the mercury out that will spread the contamination around the site. Obviously, there's runoff from the tailings piles and other mines workings as the material weathers and is exposed to the atmosphere and the environment. At some sites, additionally, there has been the use of these tailing piles and this crushed rock for road construction. At the Bonanza site, which you'll see in a couple minutes, there is extensive use of the crushed rock for roads. So, unfortunately, that's going to disperse the material widely. But that is part of the problem. And then, of course, at these gold sites, the product was, the mercury was used for the amalgamation of gold. So, you know, in just handling that material and the practices that you saw earlier, you're going to see, you know, a fairly significant opportunity for this material to be lost to the environment, either to the atmosphere or just lost in the process of using it. One of the highest priority sites we have is the Formosa site, Formosa Silver Butte. This site is of particular concern to us. It's not a mercury mine site. It was primarily used in the production of copper and zinc. This site, we feel, has had a very significant impact on the local environment. It has the acid mine discharge carries some significant concentrations of arsenic, aluminum, zinc, some other heavy metals that we believe are directly responsible for about 18 miles of stream that are significantly impacted to where they really don't support any type of aquatic life.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Fisher.
Thank you. How do you get aluminum out of the natural state? I thought it was a compounded metal out of bauxite.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, aluminum, I'm not a geology expert, but aluminum, I would assume, is just naturally present, and as it's weathered, particularly in the acidic conditions, would be pulled out of the rock with the other minerals and discharged that way.
It's not an alloy. It's not an alloy, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, no. It would be dissolved.
Why? How can you get aluminum out of the ground? If you could get aluminum out of the ground, you wouldn't have to do all this electrical process, would you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, aluminum is a naturally occurring element and is probably present in some quantities in this ore along with the other heavy metals and would just be pulled out with the other material as part of the weathering process on these tailing piles, but I'd be happy to report back to you a little bit more clearly about the aluminum issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think that it's just the bauxite is aluminum plus other elements, and the refining process is just to remove the aluminum as a pure element out of the bauxite.
Thanks so much for my chemistry.
I'll leave it to the guy who has the degree in chemistry at this point. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These minerals are all present in more complex compounds. For example, cinnabar is where the mercury is found, and that's I believe it's mercury sulfide, but the mercury is pulled out and removed from the sulfide, but I'll leave that at that. Back to Formosa, again, this is one of our higher priority sites that we're doing work on. Again, has an acid mine discharge problem, as you can see here, and also has tailing piles that we believe are contributing to the problem. We have worked in conjunction with some other agencies to understand this problem better. And also, we've done quite a bit of work with the local community as well to make them aware of this issue. We feel they're very involved. This part of the biggest concern here is that the creek that this material discharges into and is impacted is a leader stream into the watershed that becomes the city of Riddle's drinking water supply. We've done some analysis of that drinking water supply and haven't seen adverse effects of yet, but the material is there. So that definitely makes it a priority for us to look into. The last site I'd like to show the committee is the Bonanza site. The Bonanza site was the largest mercury mine in Oregon. It closed, I believe, in the 60s, and actually in 1940 was listed as the second largest producer of mercury in the country. Mercury was mined here and basically heated off the mine crushing piles and condensed in radiators and moved to these tailing dumps. The particular problem we have at Bonanza, or what makes it a priority for us, is the fact that we do have residents living in and around the site having direct contact and exposure to some of the contamination problems here. We have done some sampling and shown some impacts to the well systems and the ground. We did, as you can see here, we did an interim action a few years back to collect what we considered to be the absolute worst of it and stabilize some of that issue, some of that material. But we do believe more work needs to be done to understand what the problem is and clean it up. So that's the bulk of the specific sites. In discussing what we believe the solutions are to some of these problems, the process we use to clean up mine sites is somewhat process oriented, but we think it's important. We use essentially the same processes that are used in our other cleanup sites by doing some site discovery, doing some assessment and prioritization, and then designing some type of remedial action that we believe will fix the problem. What makes that process important in with these sites is that, number one, these sites are very remote, many of them, and because they've been around there a long time, it's often hard to find out information about what exactly went on. So, you know, doing the analysis and investigation is really important to understand exactly what the contamination is and what the problem is. Particularly when you get to the remediation phase and you want to actually clean them up, we want to make sure we've spent the time and the money properly so that we don't clean up what, spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to move a big pile of tailings that really isn't contributing to the problem if we do a little bit more background into it. The funding mechanism, again, as Mr. Danko stated, is primarily through our orphan site account, although there are other agencies that we work collaboratively with that are participating in some of these. But at least these four are all orphan sites. As far as agency and coordination cooperative work, we think this is really important and is key to the success of our efforts here. Again, we work with the Interagency Mining Group to help understand a lot of these things, but we believe that helps us leverage our valuable state resources as much as possible, and we also think it's really important to involve the community to make sure they know exactly what's going on and understand what the problem may or may not be as it affects them. And finally, just some comments on Senate Bill 817. We've done quite a bit of assessment work at some of these mine sites. We believe at this point, should this bill move forward, that at least $3 to $5 million over the next biennium is money we're prepared to spend directly on cleanup of these sites. It's not to say that some additional analysis isn't necessary at some of these sites, but we have done quite a bit of background at some of these higher priority sites and feel we could put this money to good use in direct cleanup of this material. Also a benefit would be that this work would really help us, being able to take a couple sites through to completion would help us better work with the sites that remain. There are a lot of sites around the state, and we feel that we'd be able to develop some efficiencies and some know-how in how to clean these sites, the remaining sites up. And finally, if the bill were to be considered, we'd like to work with the committee and stakeholders to take a look at some of the language that would just help free up or make it a little more easier to use the money on the highest priority sites that are causing this environmental damage. And with that,
thank you.
Again, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to present.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Fisher.
Explain how mercury becomes methylmercury.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, not a biologist, but I'll take my best shot at it. It is a biological process. Mercury is leached out of rocks or what have you into streams, and it's converted primarily through interaction, we believe, with algae and other related types of organisms that take the mercury in and basically you add a organic component to it, and it's that methyl mercury that then becomes what we believe to be the most toxic and harmful form of mercury.
It's interesting. It indicates here that this is a product of wetlands. Best we get rid of our wetlands instead of fooling around with them.
Bob, do you have an amendment proposal that you could describe a little bit to us if this becomes, you know, something we move forward with?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and because this was scheduled quite quickly, I haven't had a chance to talk to Matt Levins, OEC. They're behind the bill. We would like the committee to consider allowing us to use the money on abandoned mines that have heavy metal problems rather than just gold and mercury that is mentioned in the bill. We have arsenic, we have copper, we have acid mine drainage, and to do abandoned mines right, it would be better to not limit us to just cleaning up mines that mercury is the only problem. Secondly, the Section 3 of the bill lays out a lot of study work and reporting work that we would do. I would like an opportunity to work with whomever to kind of change the language, because that the way it's written now has a significant fiscal impact just on reporting and documenting and determining where we would rather get more bang for the buck on cleanup. And I think we can meet the intent of what's here if the language was a little different. And there might be a technical question also on line 8 of the bill that has the money going into a certain part of our pollution control fund, and I would want to talk to Ledge Council because I don't think the right reference is there.
I asked that question so others could comment later. Right now, I've kept Senator Devlin waiting, and I want to apologize for that. I do want to say that I appreciate the slides and appreciate actually getting a visual on some of this.
Mr. Chair, just one question before they leave.
Senator Fisher.
It's been brought to my attention that it lists volcanoes in here, but somehow or another it doesn't mention forest fires. And it's my understanding that if you have a forest fire going and heating up the ground where there's mercury there, you would get the vaporization and have the same effect as a volcano or anything else. And this puts a whole different ball game on the problems of our forest fires that we're having because of neglect of good forest practices and stuff like that. And yet it's not even mentioned here as a problem now. It looks to me like there's a pretty good potential of having mercury in the soil or in the arena down there where the biscuit fire was. There's evidence and stories in history of the Indians painting themselves with the red pigment and stuff of the cinnabar and having problems with their health. And that was probably even prior to the time that white men spent much time out here in Oregon. And what is, you see in here that there's talking about problems with the increase of mercury because of fallout and stuff coming through the air. Certainly Mount St. Helens would have had probably a pretty good chance of kicking some mercury off, not to mention all the other volcanic action that we've had around here in the in the state and in the Northwest in much earlier times. But is forest fires or things like that not worth pursuing to put a stop to stuff like that, putting mercury in the air?
You want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, those may be sources of mercury in the environment, but it's a little broader question that I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer at this time.
I think maybe somebody in the Department of Forestry might have a better answer. Senator Beyer just commented to me quietly that catastrophic fires, what did you say, the largest?
Well, probably the largest release of mercury. Mm-hmm. Because of what Senator Fisher said, it volatilizes the soil, takes the soil up in the atmosphere, comes back down, spreads it out all over the place.
That needs to be considered as part of this, too, I suppose. Listen, I want to thank you. If there's no more questions, I do want to give Senator Devlin, who introduced the bill, a chance to make a few comments. I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but I hope you enjoyed the slide program and some of those wonderful colored pictures of mines and so on that we had.
Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19, I did actually enjoy the slides. They were far more interesting than my Ways and Means Subcommittee. We're reviewing the most interesting budget of the Board of Standards and Practices right now. So.
But see if we can get you out of there again sometime.
But with that, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do this morning here is basically just give my introduction to Senate Bill 817. I apologize to the chair and members of the committee if some of the statements I may make might be redundant to some of the presentation that you've already heard, but I will try to be succinct and basically just to make this presentation. And then I want to make a few just a few comments about the bill itself and some work that I think that the bill needs. Senate Bill 817 deals with obviously mercury pollution and particularly mines, gold and mercury mines in this state, abandoned gold and mercury mines. Mercury pollution in Oregon comes from three major sources: mercury in products, industrial point sources, and abandoned mercury and gold mines. SB 817 focuses specifically on abandoned and inactive mercury and gold mines, which have left us with a serious environmental problem. SB 817 addresses this issue and will reduce mercury pollution by creating a dedicated fund to pay for the cleanup of an inactive and abandoned mines. Throughout the course of Oregon's history, as you've seen here, both gold and mercury mining have played a significant role. Oregon's mining activity began in the early 1800s and early 1900s and extended into the 1940s for gold production and into the 1970s for production of mercury. Mercury is a highly toxic chemical that can have a profound and long-term impact on the brain and nervous system. When released into the environment, mercury persists and builds up in the aquatic food chain, making certain fish unsafe to eat. A lack of sufficient funds to pay for the cleanup of these mines has allowed this serious environmental problem and threat to human health to continue. Obviously, the higher that you are up in the food chain, the more the potential of accumulation of mercury within your system. Obviously, we are about the highest in the food chain, so we are at the top of that level. Several studies show elevated levels of mercury in fish, water, and sediments in areas such as southwestern Oregon and central Oregon, where the production of mercury was centered. It is estimated that abandoned mines contribute a minimum of 680 pounds of mercury each year into Oregon's environment. And because many of these mines were mined so long ago, there is no viable responsible party to pay for the cleanup of these mines. So in this case, it is necessary to look for public funds to cover the costs of this cleanup. Currently, DEQ has made some progress, as you have seen, on cleaning up a handful of abandoned mines, but there are roughly 135 mercury mines identified by the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Most of them have yet to be addressed due to the lack of funds. SB 17 will give DEQ the necessary resources to address the mines that present the highest risk and thereby significantly reduce the mercury pollution and the serious threats it poses to human health. My comment just in general about this bill, there are some modifications that I think that are necessary in the bill. Obviously, the bill has a fiscal impact, and obviously because it has a fiscal impact, it will probably end up having to go to Ways and Means. Also obvious, we are in a time when access to general fund dollars is extremely limited, and where the cost of this for it states a $10 million bond would be about $1 million in this biennium, that may be about $1 million too much in terms of general fund dollars. I think what we would hope to do with the bill is make some modifications so that it meets some of those addresses some of those questions that have already come up in your discussions here today. Hopefully get it forwarded on to Ways and Means after those modifications are made, and probably get an other funds allocation to it, just in prospectively in terms of if other funds become available. My understanding is that the congressional delegation, at least some members of the congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle, have expressed an interest in this issue, and there might be a limited possibility of some federal funds coming forward. At least some of the analysis work that needs to be done, setting some of the priorities and actually making a stronger case for basically proceeding with this cleanup effort, could possibly be done with far more limited funds than what are currently in the bill. That would be our actual hope, is to go back after this hearing, do some modifications, bring it back, forward it on to Ways and Means if that was the wish of the chair and the committee, and then I would become responsible for getting the other funds allocation in Ways and Means and hopefully getting the bill passed.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you for your time this morning, Senator Devlin. I know that we have a lot of things to do this morning, so I'm wanting to keep moving. Gary Lynch, can you come share with us for a few minutes from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is, for the record, Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries Mine Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As DQ mentioned, we are also neutral on the bill. We do work with the Interagency Abandoned Mine Land Group as best we can. We are the lead agency for permitting current mining activity in the state of Oregon, and related to that is the abandoned mine land issue that exists in Oregon. I would agree most with much of whatever has been said here today, and I would add a couple of things to be brief. But the chemistry of mercury can be overwhelming, as I think we're starting to understand, and recent research would indicate that contributions of gaseous mercury, which in the past have been very difficult to measure, are now being measured. And as we go down this road to reduction of mercury in the environment, we do need to pay attention to both the geologic or the natural sources of mercury as well as the man-made sources of mercury. And well-intentioned efforts, if those contributions aren't understood, very well-intentioned efforts could go awry. That's not to say we shouldn't look at sites like Bonanza and Black Butte that clearly have had a history of mercury mining, but understanding what that contribution is and versus the halo of mercury that surrounds that particular source are perplexing and need to be addressed.
What do you mean when you say the halo of mercury that surrounds that source?
Mercury, we are a mercury-rich state, and we've had a significant history of gold mining, but mercury exists in, there are many ore bodies, that's why the mining is here, where mercury is contained in the ground, and it's concentrated in ore form when we talk about cinnabar. Cinnabar is a common ore that contains mercury. And these mercury halos, just the way it is deposited, deposited over time, whether it's volcanic basalt formations or whatever, are enriched areas of mercury that were the targets, the most concentrated areas were the ones they mined. But those halos exist around that pinpoint source. Senator Fisher brings up a very good point on the wetland issue, and when we talk about management implications for this, we may want to be careful if we construct wetlands in mercury-rich areas, because, for instance, wetlands become a sink for mercury, and there is the possible methylation process that goes on. So the geology does play a role in this, and ultimately, as we invest money in these cleanups, which we think is a very good idea, make sure we understand potential contributions from natural sources, which in some cases may exceed, which may have a larger contribution than the man-made source. But this is where it gets overwhelming. Trying to sort those out is not easy, and it's not cheap.
What you're saying is, if I asked a question of percentage of mercury, the percentage of the problem it's natural is versus human caused, it'd be very difficult to answer the questions.
It's a difficult question to answer, but it doesn't mean that we can't do anything. Certainly, if there's tailings in the stream itself, it's a very good idea to remove those. That's a great place to start. Looking at, for instance, Black Butte, once you move that, those tailings, we know that we can put a cap on those, whether it's soil and revegetation, can also dramatically reduce then the airborne contribution that might have. So there are management implications that go along with this that are practical and make sense, and it's going to be sorting out those differing contributions and what to do with them. And the only bad news here, it's not an easy thing to do. So with that, unless there are any questions, that concludes my testimony.
Any other questions? Thank you for your input. Really appreciate it. We have one more person signed up, and that's Matt Blevins from OEC. Welcome, Matt. We're glad you're here this morning. I need to say that we'll be following suggestions we've heard already from Senator Devlin and others talking about this, outside of the group. So I want to make this as quick as I can and move on to the other bill.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Shields and members of the committee. Again, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. We did bring this bill forward for consideration and won't touch on a lot of the points that have been said, but we'll just reiterate that we do, again, believe that the mercury contamination problem is a serious health problem here in Oregon. We do want to also note that, again, as been noted earlier, the abandoned mine segment and the contamination we see from abandoned mines in terms of mercury is only one part of the bigger problem we're seeing with mercury, and again are expecting the committee to be looking at an additional bill, Senate Bill 818, which is in a part of the bigger mercury package that we have brought forward this session that considers not only abandoned mines but also point sources and mercury containing products that are also a source. So I've handed out a number of materials that address both the specific bill that we're talking about today but then also the bigger mercury problem and the other elements of SB 818 that deals with mercury. The only other points that I will just want to touch on today are that generally we do support the idea of polluter pays in terms of cleaning up pollution, but as has been noted earlier, this is one of the cases where there aren't really clear responsible parties that can be tapped to pay for or cover the cleanup of this type of contamination. So it really does fall to the public to cover the cost and the responsibility for this cleanup at this point. So that's why we came to this approach of a bonding package to do this type of cleanup, because it really seemed to be the only manageable way to do that. Again, recognizing where the state is, we are more than happy to try to work with the committee and other members in the legislature to try to identify federal or other funds that can be used to fund this type of cleanup if they're available, but we're still pursuing that opportunity at this point. I think one of the other things that's really important for folks to think about when you're looking at mercury contamination, whether it's mines or other sources, is to recognize that the real threat that we see from mercury isn't just in its elemental form, but it is really more when it's converted to methylmercury and then exposed to the food chain. And so I think when we raise things like mercury in the crust and in soils across Oregon, part of the real question here in terms of what kind of impact they have on human health and the environment is, are they accessible to the environment? are they things that can leach out, can contaminate water, can contaminate air, things like that. And that's why it varies, and that's why we've focused on abandoned mines and products and point sources, because those are really the identifiable sources that are having an impact on human health. So that's what we're trying to do here, and that's we're happy to work with the committee and other members to come up with a bill that works for everybody. We acknowledge that there's some amendments that need to be done right off the bat. Partly, we got the draft back from LC and didn't have a chance to change it before we had to drop the bill. So with that, I'll take questions.
Obviously, this morning's presentation gave us a lot of information I didn't know before. Maybe some of my committee members know a lot more than me, but I appreciate that information. It raises lots of questions. So we'll be talking with lots of people in the days ahead. Thank you for your presentation this morning.
Great. Thank you.
And with that, I'd like to close the hearing on 817 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 671. And as soon as Judith has a chance, I'm going to have her begin our discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 671 requires the State Department of Agriculture to develop a separate type of pesticide applicator license and a separate examination process, programs of instruction, and educational courses for persons who trim trees and apply pesticides to tree stumps on behalf of a utility. It allows the department to enter into agreements with the State of Washington for reciprocal pesticide applicator licensing of persons also trimming trees on behalf of a utility. Mr. Chair, we have received a no revenue impact on the measure, and I just passed out, we received this morning the fiscal on Senate Bill 671, which indicates, first of all, it's not anticipated in the governor's budget, and they do estimate the department would need to invest approximately $20,000 to develop this new licensing category. They're expecting the department can absorb the costs within existing fee revenues and other fund expenditure limitations, but it also does recognize that the department may need to come to the emergency board if expenditures exceed expectations. You have also the -1 amendments at your seat at the dais. Those amendments simply delete pesticides and insert herbicides so that people are applying herbicides while trimming the trees for utilities. It would make that change in the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Judith. I'm going to first call Mark Anderson up from IBEW Local 125.
Can I bring him?
Sure. Bring him along. That helps too.
Friday.
Huh?
Are we meeting Friday?
Yes, I believe we're meeting Friday.
Oh, I thought I saw no meeting. It must be end of the week.
That's at the end of the month. In-district day.
Yeah, we have an in-district day coming up.
Okay.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Mark Anderson. I'm Government Affairs Manager for International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 125 out of Portland. For the record, I am also representing IBW Local 659 out of Medford at their behest. I have to say that after that first presentation, I feel a little bit sheepish with our bill, with all the leaching and horrible things happening, but we do want to present our bill as best we can. And I brought Bill Stone with me, who is he is director of the Northwest Joint Apprenticeship Training Council in Portland. First off, between Local 659 and Local 125, we represent approximately 500 utility tree trimmers in Oregon. And as you can imagine, in Oregon, trimming around utility lines is extremely important. And also, the PUC in Oregon has strong guidelines that they enforce. So I suspect that utility tree trimming gets more focus in Oregon than anywhere else in the United States, for good reason. I think it inures to the benefit of customers in better service, fewer outage minutes, fewer public hazards. I'd also like to thank Senator Shields, Senator Corcoran, and Senator Fisher for your sponsorship of this bill. I wanted to give you a little bit of history on our approach with this. About March 2001, Bill Stone and I and others met with the Department of Agriculture to talk about this issue. At that time, we believed that we reached a verbal agreement that, yes, there was a necessity for a stump treatment category because of the nature of the work of utility tree trimmers. And Bill will go into a little more detail about the limited work that they do along right-of-ways. We put together category requirements at the department's request and have heard nothing since then after several requests. So this bill is our approach to try and push the issue forward. We also ask you to approve the Dash 1 amendment that you mentioned, Judith. And I'd like to turn it over right now to Bill Stone. As I mentioned, Bill is the director of the Northwest Joint Apprenticeship Training Council. As such, he administers all apprenticeships for both tree trimmers and linemen in the Northwest. So, Bill.
Thank you. Chairman Shields, I'm Bill Stone, training director with Northwest Line Apprenticeship. Northwest Line Apprenticeship is a labor management apprenticeship committee. We have registered tree trimmer apprenticeship programs in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon. In the state of Washington, we brought the same issue up with the Department of Agriculture in the state of Washington. We had a couple of meetings with the department up there, and were able to develop a stump treatment category licensing program up there. It went from two tests of 100 questions each to one test of 65 questions, and we were better able to train our apprentices in the specific information that they needed to treat stumps. In Oregon, we attempted the same with the Oregon State Department of Agriculture and have not been able to come to any sort of compromise with them on coming up with a category license just for a stump treatment. We still have the laws and safety tests we're required to take, and the rights of way category license we're required to take. And the right-of-way license is much too broad for the type of work we do. One example is there's five questions on identification of weeds, and we're given this book with 300 pictures of weeds, and we don't know which ones are going to be on the test, so we spend a lot of time identifying weeds. We don't treat weeds. We just treat cut stumps. And we're also another book we have is a weed control manual with all the different chemicals and stuff, their effects on different types of weeds. Again, there's a lot of information here we're required to study, and it doesn't pertain to what we do. And that's why one of the reasons we're asking for this stump treatment category. We spend a lot of time and effort teaching much too broad of a category. And the State of Washington program has allowed us to, I think, better prepare the individuals for the type of work they're doing and do a much safer and effective job. So that's basically what we're asking for, is a much more appropriate category for the stump treatment classification.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
You know, I signed on to this thing for several reasons. And number one is I get sick and tired of seeing all the fiscal things of what it does to government and no fiscal on what it's going to save people or what it's costing out there in the private sector to do some of these things. And I'm a small-time farmer, and I'm here to tell you with the pesticide law, reporting law, I'm going to use no more pesticides. Blasted thistles and everything else can grow in my place, and I don't care. I don't have a big enough farm to afford to have a computer system, and I'm not going to mess around with computer reporting on using two or three cups of crossbow or something like that, or a little Roundup around my implement yard and so forth. And it's an absolute travesty what we're doing to these people. I signed on because this has got a nice broad relating clause. we could sit down here and get a committee together, and we could have a license situation where everybody went up the ladder, just like we do similar to a nurse's training or something like that. You know, you can take your CNA and work toward LPN, and take an LPN and work toward a nurse. You could do the same thing with this. It wouldn't cost the department hardly a dime, and then people could go as far as they needed to go in the training, and you could have it if you don't qualify for C, you skip over to 7 or 8 or whatever the case might be. And it doesn't have to be a complicated thing. It doesn't have to cost the Department of Agriculture a whole lot, and it would allow our people to do something reasonable.
I like your analogy. What you're saying is these people are working at a CNA level and they're requiring them to get an RN.
No, I'm not saying that. Well, so, yeah, that's about what it amounts to. Plus the fact that your wife can go down and buy a quart of Tordon and go apply it any old way she wants, 10 times the application strength, anywhere she wants on her property, as long as it's not, you know, property that you're making money on. And most of us don't make a whole lot of money on our houses and our residence. And yet an applicator can't go use 2 teaspoons full of that stuff out of a 5-gallon can without all kinds of licensing. Now you tell me the justification and the reasoning for that kind of action. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Thank you, Senator Fisher.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. What kind of applicator's license do you currently have to get?
We have to get the rights of way, and that would be the same that the state would use for spraying a roadway, you know, with all different types of weeds on the sides of the roadway. Some of the training we have to do is we have to be able to calibrate a boom sprayer and know the different types of tips that would go on a boom sprayer if you're spraying a field. We have to, what are some of the other things?
And yet you never use a boom sprayer.
No, when we're treating stumps, we use a hand sprayer, and it's, you know, just a bottle with a little squirt handle on it. And it's and we don't do that much of it. The general public does not want herbicides. You know, usually they don't want us to use herbicides on their property. And with the limited time that we can use those, it's, you know, it's just you go to the truck and get the thing out of the side of the bin and squirt the few stumps that you're able to squirt. And usually most of our work's inside the city, and we don't use it at all in the cities. It's not worth the hassle of when you pull a little sprayer out and start spraying somebody's yard. There's all kinds of questions that come up and fears, and so it's just usually we don't use it that much. But we do applications on like Bonneville rights of ways, where it's a big power line, and we do use sprayers, and the rights of way licensing is appropriate there. But we could probably train, you know, 4 or 5 people in our local union that would do that job on a consistent year-round basis, and those 5 people would need that license and would maintain that instead of having 600 people maintain that license that don't do that type of work. And when we do that training, we hire people to come in, and they come in for a day to do the licensing training and then take the test, and then they come in 2 weeks later and do the rights of way training. So they're you know, taking 2 days a year to get that license on their own time.
Senator Beyer has another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the right of way license, is that a commercial applicator's license or a private applicator's license?
We go under the commercial applicator's license.
Okay, so you have to first pass the private applicator's license before you can. Because, I mean, Senator Fisher and Terry Witt or someone from the Department of Ag can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought first you have to take these in graduated steps. You have private applicator's license, commercial applicator's license, dealer's license, and so the Department of Ag is shaking their heads and you don't have to pass one before you pass the other. So, okay. And then one more thing. Couldn't you do the same thing now, have 3 or 4 people get the right-of-way license and they're the ones that do the spraying?
Yeah, you could do that if that's what happens on the major right-of-ways. You know, a small group of the people do the bulk of that work. But what we have is we have 3-man crews out there working on for the contractors, and they all have to apply the stump treatment herbicide. You know, on an occasional basis. So you have to have at least one person trained. And for the contractors to be able to man their crews and move them all around, if you just had a third of your people trained, you'd have to move those people around and have two other people working with them. So our union and the labor and the management committees have decided we need to have everybody trained in these licenses. So we make sure that we have the right amount of people on the jobs. It would be just too mind-boggling to try to get that one out of three persons on each cruise. So I hope that makes sense.
Chairman Shields, can I respond to Senator Fisher?
Yeah.
You mentioned, Senator Fisher, the cost of doing business, and that is really a huge issue here for the tree trimming companies. There's two main companies in Oregon, and these tree trimmers trim up to a million volts, and a lot of it is 70-plus percent of it is done live, so they have to know what they're doing, and they have to spend their time wisely during their two-year apprenticeship. And in our estimation, this is overkill that actually is detrimental to the rest of their training that is very, very much safety related. So you hit on something that is near and dear to our hearts, that this is time that's wasted, quite frankly, where they could be learning safety practices or other things that are germane to their job.
Other questions? If you fellows can step back a minute, we'll hear from Lisa Hansen and Chris Kirby, both from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. To give you a chance to make your presentation and then have a few questions if we have them afterwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture. I'd like to talk just briefly about the process that was used in meeting with the IBEU previously. The department did meet with the IBEU some time ago. Some time ago to talk about their interest in creating a category for cut stump treatments. After that initial discussion, a broader group was brought in that does similar types of work in similar sites. And there was additional discussion that took place. As I understand it, it was left that IBEW would bring some information back to the agency to look at and work through this issue. As background on the pesticide licensing program in Oregon, Oregon currently has 11 categories of pesticide applicators, and there are some 15 subcategories within those. An Oregon applicator's license, known as right-of-way, is what's currently used for individuals doing cut stump treatments. This category is approved by the Environmental Protection Agency and is recognized by the state of Washington for reciprocal licensing. To obtain a pesticide applicator's license in Oregon in any category, an individual is required to take a 100-question test on laws and safety of pesticide use pertaining to Oregon, as well as an examination for the specific purpose in which they are requesting a license. For example, an agricultural producer would take a laws and safety test as well as an agricultural applicator's examination. Oregon's licensing system allows licensed pesticide applicators to purchase restricted-use pesticides. These products are the most toxic pesticides that pose the most potential to harm people or the environment. Under the current system in Oregon, any individual that is a licensed pesticide applicator can purchase restricted-use products. So if an individual is licensed for this very specific purpose of doing cut stump treatments, they would have access to these restricted use products as well. As an alternative, pesticide dealers could be required to differentiate these individuals from other licensees. However, this option would increase the pesticide dealer's responsibilities as well as put the potential dealers at risk of violating both federal and state law because restricted use pesticides cannot be sold to individuals who do not hold valid applicators' licenses.
Senator Fisher.
I'm going to ask one specific question. Is Toradana restricted use?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, yes, Toradon is a restricted-use pesticide. I'm aware of one product that is a ready-to-use product that has an amount of Toradon in it as an active ingredient that is available as a general-use product.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
You can purchase Toradon without any license whatsoever in one-quart capacity. You go above one-quart capacity, you can't.
That's not correct.
It's happening. Put it that way.
Let's move on with the testimony, and we'll sort this out in a little bit.
Providing a license for this, such a specific purpose, such as cut stump treatments, is not conducive to the training and examination process that has been established as a standard for Oregon. There are several licenses that are somewhat similar to this, such as a seed treatment license. However, those individuals are required to go through the full testing and training process. If such a specific site were developed for cut stump treatments and that were implemented in Oregon as proposed in Senate Bill 671, individuals would not be allowed to control blackberries, noxious weeds, scotch broom, or other brush species with pesticide products that would be in the same work area and to clear those areas as they're able to do now with the category that they're licensed under. And with that, I would be happy to answer questions, and I brought Chris Kirby with me, who is the expert in terms of the pesticides division and the regulations for licensing.
Okay.
Question.
Go ahead. Senator.
Well, I'm a little curious about the last comment. I mean, my understanding was that it was the tree stump issue that they wanted to train to and not the eradication of these other plants. So why would you throw that up as a argument in favor of not allowing him to have a more concise license?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, as I understand it, they're doing the cut stump treatments, but in the areas where they are doing these treatments, there could be these other species of weeds, scotch broom, blackberries, that could need to be treated as well. And specific license.
Yeah.
Can I just get some indication from the IBEW if that's the case or not? One of you come up, just say something, please.
Bill Stone again, and Senator Corcoran, Chair. We're basically dealing with the vegetation that grows up into the power lines, and scotch broom and blackberries aren't the main vegetation we're dealing with. We do deal with that type of vegetation in some instances, like around substations and on the major right-of-ways, and that would be covered under the rights-of-way license. But what we're talking about is a stump treatment license, is we're trimming trees around power lines, and occasionally we cut some small trees. We're able to cut them off at the stump, and then we want to treat those stumps. And that's what we want to do with this license category.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, great questions.
Sure. Senator Bond.
And I don't know if you're the right person, but you say the right-of-way license now is a two-day process for them to get a right-of-way license, and it covers your basic pesticide safety knowledge and then an additional test. Is that what I heard you say?
For the record, my name is Chris Kirby. I'm the administrator of the Pesticides Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, the training that's offered, and that's offered through community colleges as well as the union itself, has training. my understanding that generally through the community colleges, the laws and safety training is about an 8-hour training. And then for the right-of-way category exam, varies from 4 to 8. Again, Mr. Stoner could probably speak more directly to what the union training is, but I believe it's similar timelines.
So we're basically talking about a 2-day process here. And then is the first test, the one off at community colleges or whatever, is that equivalent to a private pesticide applicator's license?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, the examinations that you're referencing, private applicator and then commercial or public applicator in the right-of-way category, are quite different examinations. The private applicator exam is required of persons producing agricultural or forest crop using restricted-use pesticides virtually on their own lands, whereas the commercial applicator license is intended for persons who are working on other people's lands in public situations, and under Oregon law, addresses not just restricted use materials but all pesticides that they might be using. So they are different situations, they are different examinations. The private applicator exam is a total of 100 questions. It does cover laws and safety as well as more general safe practices actions as opposed to the category exams, which are specific to those sites.
Okay, are these commercial applicators licensed? Are they? What's their duration once you get one? As far as it like 5 years, like the private applicator is?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, the qualification, the certification to hold the license, which is obtained through the successful completion of specific written exams, is good for 5 years. That's true for both the private applicator and the commercial applicator. The licenses themselves are different. The private applicator license is issued for a 5-year period. The commercial license is issued on an annual basis. Both types of licenses require recertification on a 5-year basis, either through the attendance of approved training sessions or through reexamination.
Okay, and we also have a category of a public applicator license, is that correct? Is that for government entities that they can get?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, that's correct. There is another license type called public applicator, which is intended for employees of government agencies. The categories, the exams, the requirements for recertification are identical for public applicators as they are for commercial applicators.
Then why did we create another license type for them last
time? Good point.
If they're identical.
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, the current version of Oregon Revised Statute 634 of the Oregon Pesticide Control Act was written in 1973. It's been that way since then. I'm not aware of the different license type that you're referencing.
Well, there's a public applicator and a commercial applicator, correct?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, that is correct.
And didn't you just say that the tests for them are identical?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, that is correct.
You understand this question?
The difference between the two licenses is that the public applicator license is specifically intended for an employee of a public agency and is not valid when that person is not employed by that public agency. The commercial applicator license is intended for employees of commercial operators, but that license goes with them. They can change companies. So there are some differences about the license, but not in the qualifications, the requirements to get and hold the license.
Okay. And is poured on the basic chemical we're talking about they're trying to use here?
Senator Shields, Senator Beyer, I don't believe that I can answer that question. I don't know exactly all the materials that they're talking about. There is a Tordon RTU that's available for this particular purpose. I understand there are other products that they could be using as well.
I just mentioned Tordon because that was one I was familiar with.
You could bring the IBAW guy. He can tell you what chemicals they get exposed to.
Yes, Senator Shields, we're using Garlon 3, and I don't believe that's a restricted use pesticide, is it?
No.
It's not a restricted use pesticide. You could buy that over the counter, and property owners could apply it themselves with no licensing.
You don't use Tordon?
No, we don't.
So you go through 2 days or more of training and workshops and all that just to be able to use it commercially would
right, and then,
be sold,
you know,
across the county.
Another issue there, too, is once you get the license, you have to get 40 hours of training through before the next licensing period, 5 years, or you take the test again. And we would like to have a more appropriate test, so we could just take the test again instead of sending people out, paying them wages to go out and get the 40. That's an additional week of cost to maintain that license to do what we're talking about, spray a stump occasionally with a non-restricted use pesticide.
So while you're there, it's what you're using, a pesticide or a herbicide?
Excuse me, that's what it'd be, a herbicide. I guess the broader category is pests. They're all pests. A weed is a pest. A rodent is a pest. So,
Senator Shields, if I could provide some clarification to that question and the response. Under both state and federal laws, materials intended to control a pest or repel a pest are considered pesticides. That pest might be a weed. There are various types of pesticides, including insecticides, fungicides, herbicides. So the way federal and state law look at it, an herbicide would be a type of pesticide.
To me, this is why the legislature, Mr. Chair.
So a lead bullet could be a pesticide in certain industries.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. So this license you're asking for, would you believe then you would be allowed to use a restricted use herbicide or pesticide if you had a squirt, a stump treatment license?
I would think that we would be able to use any appropriate pesticide that the license covered, and I'm not sure how to answer that question. But I think with the proper training and the application that we used, whatever the licensing was, whatever the licensing category allowed us to use, we'd be able to use. And I'm not sure that we think Garlon is about the only pesticide we're using, probably in 90% of the applications, and probably higher percentage of that of the work that we do. And Tordon, I worked with Bonneville Power at one time, and we did a lot of right-of-way spraying, and back then we used a lot of Tordon, and I think that the use of Tordon is they don't use it much anymore. There's quite a few problems with it and stuff, but I can't think of a restricted use pesticide that we'd be using. So I really don't have a good answer to your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would hazard a guess that these things change with time, too. I mean, new things are invented, and different combinations work better, and they're doing research on stuff like this all the time, but it's about as stupid as coming back here and dealing with a meat animal every time that somebody decides they want to eat an alpaca or a bison or a camel or something like that. You can get a generic terminology for this, and what's common use in the industry or common use for that practice ought to be able to be covered, and it shouldn't have to be revisited by a legislative process every year or every 2 years. But I would like to ask the Department of Agriculture why you can't have a step type license now. And again, I'm not familiar with federal law on some of this.
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, Oregon law is more stringent than federal law, and current Oregon law requires that a business that applies pesticides on the property of another be licensed as an operator. Their employees then are subject to licensing, again, because they're putting pesticides on the property of another. We actually have 3 different licenses that we make available to employees of such businesses. Those are the commercial applicator license, fully certified, people can work on their own. And then there are 2 types of trainee licenses, directly supervised and and then immediately supervised. These individuals work under the supervision of a licensed applicator, directly supervised. They've gone through a partial examination process, as it were, and they are allowed to work on their own, providing they have communication then with their supervising applicator. The immediately supervised have to be in contact while they're using the pesticide with their supervising applicator. So we have made provision based upon the wording of the statute for some tiering, as you present it. There are certainly other ways that this could be done, but this is the way the agency has interpreted the existing statutes for quite some time.
Mr. Chairman, is there any opportunity for them to consider it a little differently under their OARs?
Senator Shields.
Latitude like that in the present law?
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, we created not too many years ago the immediately supervised trainee based upon our interpretation that, yes, since the statute made authorization for trainee licensing, we could divvy that up, and we did, as an accommodation to the industry. The sort of tiering that you're referencing, I guess I would have to think through some more and look at the statute with that sort of thought in mind. I'm not sure that I can answer that definitively right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I personally am not ready to vote to just put one little spectrum of this in process. I think that there could be something valuable coming out of getting a work group together and looking at this thing so that we make it to where it's a little more feasible, not only for the Department of Agriculture, but for everybody.
In other words, what you're wanting to do, instead of addressing this specific problem in isolation, is to address the range
prefer to do it and get it out of our hair and allow people to go about things much more reasonably.
That would be a big question versus a small one.
Maybe not.
Yes, listen, I want to thank you for your coming and sharing with us. We do have one more person, and that's Terry Witt from the Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and I want to get him up here and have him have his opportunity to testify, as he's coming very quickly.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that the state of Washington is under the same federal laws, and we were able to work out a compromise with them on a rather quick basis, and I'm just wondering why that can't happen here.
Very good point.
But you just said our laws are stricter than the federal government, which I've said time and time and again. Why do we push our people farther than what the federal government requires?
Terry, I want to thank you for coming this morning. Look forward to hearing your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I think, first of all, maybe to preface my comments, I think one of the things that this hearing does do is it demonstrates how cumbersome and particularly burdensome some of our regulations can be on businesses. And as Senator Fisher had commented, we typically look at fiscal impact on the government, and we forget about the fiscal impact to the farmer, to the forester, to the small business owner. And unfortunately, many times the total fiscal impact to the business community is far, far greater than the impact to the government, and it never seems to get considered in the decision making. I'd like to say, first of all, that Mark Anderson from the IBEW did come to me and share with me his legislative counsel on draft on this bill, and we discussed it. And matter of fact, I think the one amendment that was proposed narrowing the term pesticides to that of herbicides came at my request, or my recommendation that they narrow it down as much as possible to alleviate as much of the potential concern as they could. I think I also indicated that maybe if it was only dealing with applications on rights of way and not private property, that might be another narrowing that could relieve some stress. And as I said, obviously that narrowing, at least from the herbicide perspective, did take place. I also commented to Mark that we take this before our board of directors and discuss it, because it is kind of a diversion from the normal policy as to how we license applicators in the state. And our board did not vote to endorse or support this particular bill. And I think there was a number of reasons why. One was they were concerned about diluting the efforts of the Department of Agriculture in its certification program of professional applicators and privately licensed applicators. Under the circumstances that we're in with limited resources, I believe the department would be required to probably do with what they have rather than put on additional personnel and receive additional budgets to develop and implement a very specific subcategory or special limited license. And we believe that that in itself could be problematic because we do not want to see our licensed applicators the attention paid to them and the qualifications that they are required to maintain to see that dumbed down in any way. The other thing was that we run into this problem, and I believe the department alluded to it, a problem of certification. When you have an EPA certified license, that really gives you the authority then to buy a restricted use pesticide. And I'm presuming that this limited license that we're talking about here for cut stump treatment would not be a certified license allowing the license holder to go out and purchase unlimited restricted use pesticides. If that's the case, the other real concern that we had is the confusion that could create within the dealer community. Now they have a different kind of licensure they have to look at rather than if the individual is licensed by the ODA, they're able to buy these materials. It also creates, I think, some problems from an enforcement perspective. The finer you slice the pie, so to speak, the more attention it takes from the dealer and also from the enforcement people to ensure that the people are operating within their designated area. And what I'd also like to do is say that the bill really deals with two issues. The first issue, I think, is one that can be easily handled. That's the issue of reciprocity. Will we have a reciprocal licensing agreement in Oregon with the state of Washington? And I think the bill uses the term may, so it doesn't force the department to accept a license from Washington. And I think from that perspective, we don't have a problem with the bill from the reciprocal perspective, but would like to make it clear on the record that we think the key to reciprocal licensing is equivalency. If the individual asking for reciprocity or reciprocal licensing in Oregon has equal or better qualifications than the state of Oregon, then reciprocal licensing would obviously be something that we think could be accomplished. If not, then we would be opposed again to having the standards lowered in the state of Oregon. The second part of the bill, which really deals with this development of a limited license, I think is really an issue that maybe Senator Fisher has hit upon. It's a policy issue that the legislature is looking at, and it's really not, are we going to create or charge the department with creating a cut stump treatment license? What we're really doing is we're telling the department we're making a policy decision or asking the legislature to make a policy decision to have the department create potentially unlimited number of subcategories or limited licensure for application of pesticides. And if that is an endeavor that the legislature would like to see the department do for a number of reasons, then I think the department has to look at the full spectrum of limited licenses that might be requested and might be practical. And the reason I say that's important is because it was one of the first things that happened when we started discussing this issue at our board of directors was a forestry person said, does that mean if they get that license for rights of way, can I get that license for my tree planters? And so the idea being that once you start the process, it's very difficult to stop. And I think so. I think the legislature needs to look at it from a policy perspective. You know, is this something we want the department and the state of Oregon to do with regard to licensure? And I'll close with, I agree with Senator Fisher's comments that we have some real disparity in some of our laws between what licensed applicators can do and what the homeowner can do. But I would just leave the committee with this thought that I hope we're not going to do anything which lowers the professionalism or the quality of our applicators simply because the homeowner doesn't require training. I would much prefer to elevate the knowledge level and the competency of a homeowner rather than dumb down our current applicators. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. I have a conundrum on my hands in the committee, as you're probably aware. I had feedback urging us to move to a work session on this specific bill and do it now and get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
All the way from that to Senator Fisher's concept that maybe we need to address the whole thing. And both he and I come from a human services arena where we went through that process of seeing, you know, certified nursing assistants at one level and other levels, intermediary all the way up to registered nurses and everybody having licenses that are very clear. And so I understand the model, you know, the concept that he's working with. Where would you come down if you were, I mean, you know, when this came to me, it looked like a simple little bill to address a specific. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at something that the Department of Agriculture could scratch their head and say, how do you get your arms around that? And yet, at the other end, it seems kind of foolish that guys that just want to cut down a tree and deal with a stump, and I don't even know why you have to deal with it at all because they don't deal with it inside city limits, you know, you have a suggestion.
Chair Shields, I agree with you. It is a real conundrum. First of all, the reason they do treat the cut stump is to keep it from resprouting, and I think anyone that's dealt with things like alder, you cut a stump and you get 5 resprouts for every stump you cut. So it's a long-term solution to not having to go back and treat and retreat over and over again every year. So in some instances, it is really necessary. I think, you know, I too started out looking at this from a rather simplistic perspective and said, that makes a lot of sense. It's practical. You know, if a guy's just gonna have a jug of ready to use Roundup on his hip when he's doing his job, train him on how to use ready to use Roundup and be done with it. You know, give him the safety training and the training of the laws so that he knows what not to do with regard to the environment and human exposure. But then, as I said, when the issue is brought up and all of a sudden you start having other members of our board saying, well, okay, great, you know, how about us? And what I heard, I think what I heard from the individual that was in term dealing with the apprentice program even perhaps scares me a little more, which to me almost sounded like they were looking at getting a specific license for a product. If you know, you could get at that definitive that says, okay, this individual is only going to be licensed for a cut stump treatment using Garlon 3A. And then you run into the problem, as Senator Fisher was commenting, that this is a ever-changing technology, and you know, we're getting different chemicals, better chemicals, those that you don't have to use as often. That's why I say it really is a policy decision, I think, for the legislature to wrestle with. Do we want to look at limited licensure? And if so, what kind of restrictions would we put on that with regard to things like buying restricted use chemicals? And perhaps the idea that the senator had about putting together a broader work group just to look at it and get some better definition from the department as to if they had to create additional licensure, what would it cost? And would the additional cost be worth the benefit, I guess, would be my recommendation.
Well, Senator Fisher, it sounds like you've got
volunteered for a job.
Senator Byer says it sounds like you volunteered for a job.
Well, I don't care. I'm willing to take it on because I'm sick and tired of piling these regulations on people. That's where our number one problem with our jobs is going right now. Well, we've got too blame many regulations. Most of them aren't reasonable.
Let me ask you a question. Terry, would you be willing to join with the others who have testified this morning? It's interesting. That's a nice little group of about five people. And see if we can, with Senator Fisher convening you, work on this a little bit and come back to us?
Chair Shields, I would be glad to do that. I would think that we would want to also take a look at the other areas where it may be appropriate, such as forestry, and bring in private right-of-way people.
Yeah, don't leave out agriculture.
Right. No, I'm not. I'm certainly not.
Chair, this issue also came up, I know, in the state of Washington, for example, about 3 years ago. A very similar issue came up dealing with control of noxious weeds in rangeland, where they were looking to form a very limited licensure for folks on the range to very specifically use, I think, a rope wick type of application, which is just a wipe on material onto noxious weeds. And they ran into the same conundrum. You know, how far do you go when you start then subdividing categories and restricting or limiting or reducing the amount of education that people get with requirements for licensure? So it's... The interesting thing is that, from my understanding, the only state in the union that has a limited license is the state of Washington for a cut stump treatment. None of the other states have such an animal. So that may indicate that perhaps it's may not be all that good of an idea.
Either they're a pioneer or it may be
following. That's
true. Is the way to interpret that. Terry, I appreciate you coming. Senator Fisher, it looks like there were two people from the Department of Agriculture here this morning. Two testified from IBEW, and then you had Terry. And that seems to me to be a pretty good little work group, if you can pull them together. And it certainly includes the Department of Agriculture.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would recommend someone from the Farm Bureau and maybe someone from the forest industry also.
That'd be fine by me. I'll leave that to you and Senator Fisher and myself to add as necessary. Is that okay?
That's fine.
I'd like to ask one more question while we've got people here and have it on the record. A public license is the same as a commercial license, but the person with a public license cannot go out and do commercial work. I need to know two or three things here, and I'd like to have it on the record. Can that person with that license go out and buy restricted chemical use for himself and his own situation? Does that limit his buying power? Do the businesses now that supply these things have to look at that license and say, no, you can't buy it? How does the state get around it, or the federal government, or county or city or whatever it is, get around it? Do they have the right to go buy these things without a license and yet let their licensed people use them? And are these licenses bought by the public entities for these people, or do these people pay their own? If they paid their own, why couldn't they get a commercial license and work for themselves if they wanted to, too, and save the government agencies the trouble of buying their license and the expense of buying their license?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I'll let Chris handle the first couple. The latter question, I think, was actually addressed by the legislature last session when we, in fact, did have public applicators hiring out for commercial spray in, particularly on the east side, to do roadside work. They were actually contracting out and becoming competitors for the commercial applicators. We made some modifications to the public applicators license that restricted what they could do and basically restricted them from going into the, quote, the commercial applicator business. But with regard to the first question, I'll defer that to Chris.
Again, for the record, my name is Chris Kirby with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, if I'm recalling your question correctly, you were asking about differences between public applicator and commercial applicator licensing. That licensing is actually established in statute and does make a distinction between those two individuals, the public applicator license being required of those people, as I said before, that work for a government agency. That does allow them on behalf of their agency to obtain and use restricted use pesticides. It does not authorize them under the law to obtain restricted use materials for their own use, either say on their own farming operation or for them to as it were moonlight as a commercial operator or applicator. So that license is intended for them just while they're working for their agency. And I'm not sure I'm answering that
you
question.
You are answering my question, but that leads to another one, and that is, if they had a commercial applicator's license they bought on their own, can they work for you and then buy public chemicals without getting a public license?
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, the way the statute is put together, if they are an employee of a government agency, then they're required to have the public applicator license. Although the requirements are the same to get the two different licenses, they are treated as different licenses. So no, if
would buy one if they already had a commercial applicator's license. The government would have to buy another one.
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, that's the way we interpret the statute, is that the commercial applicator license does not cover them when they are an employee of a government agency.
No, there's another place you can save a little money.
The only thing that I want to say in closing real quickly is that I don't want anybody to drag their feet on this. We're running out of time here, and if we're going to do it, I'm going to ask Judith to make sure that we proceed with all diligence. And Senator Fisher, I appreciate your help. You know what kind of timelines that we're facing from the chair. So I hope you and Judith can pull these folks together and march down the road as fast as possible.
We're working my staff and move appointments around, whatever you have to do.
Okay. With that, I want to thank you this morning. We've had a very interesting hearing this morning, and we're adjourned.